The Guardian.
Welcome to a Euro edition of Politics Weekly. Yes, we're all standing to attention for the European Union's anthem, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, as we turn our attention to Europe. As European leaders gather in Brussels for their midsummer summit, we'll be looking at the future of the European Union after Irish voters rejected the Lisbon Treaty in a referendum last week. And we'll be asking whether the treaty is finally dead and what the Irish no vote means for Britain, which is top of the EU class because it formally ratified the treaty as the summit began. We've lined up three Euro experts for the show. From the House of Commons, we are joined by Dennis McShane, the former Europe Minister, who is a passionate supporter of the EU. Dennis, you must be in mourning after that no vote.
Of course, but this is absolutely normal. Europe's been there before, will be there again. Europe's still going to be around, despite the efforts of all those who want to destroy it.
From Strasbourg, we are joined by Daniel Hannan, the Eurosceptic Conservative MEP, who staged a protest in the European Parliament on Wednesday, calling for the Irish vote to be recognised. Dan, I take it you are jumping for joy.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't jumping when you were playing the anthem. I was writhing around like Alex in A Clockwork Orange, shouting it's a sin using Ludwig van like that. But yeah, of course, I'm delighted and well done to the Irish people.
And finally, we are joined by David Hurst, The Guardian's foreign affairs leader writer, who is our former Ireland correspondent. David, The Guardian wrote last week that what will happen next week is as clear as peat soil.
Yes, it did. And it's still just as unclear today as it was when I wrote that.
Thanks for that. When I ask Ian Traynor, The Guardian's Europe editor, to tell us what will happen at the summit, I began by asking Ian whether the EU is facing a full-blown crisis.
Crisis is a much overused word here, Nick, as you well know. Might be a wee bit early to talk about a full-blown crisis. Certainly the potential for one is there, depending on where we go from here. That is the question that European leaders will start to try answering on Thursday. Depending on where they get to, there's certainly the scope for quite a serious crisis, yes.
And do you think that this summit, where essentially the Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowan is going to report back formally, tell fellow European leaders what has happened and what Ireland's going to do, do you think this will help them clamber out of the hole, or do you think they could go even further into the hole by the end of the summit?
I would doubt whether they'll be digging themselves deeper into a hole by the end of the summit. There's bound to be some kind of declaration expressing sympathy and understanding for the Irish difficulties, or at least the difficulties of the Irish government, let's say, and the Irish people don't seem to be too bothered. The issue really is about how to start climbing out of this hole. And then you get into arguments about timing and whether there's a quick fix or not. But what we don't really know is actually what either side is actually going to do in order to craft some kind of solution to the question of what happens to the Lisbon Treaty fundamentally.
In the old days, there was a very simple way out of the crisis when a small country voted no. You just asked them to vote again, as we did with the Nice Treaty in, I think it was, 2000 with the Irish. That trick presumably cannot be played again.
Au contraire, as they say in Brussels. Never say never. I understand that Cowan will make it quite plain to his fellow European leaders that a referendum rerun is absolutely out of the question for the time being. There is a kind of consensus emerging here that probably a second referendum, couched with lots of caveats and declarations of exceptionalism for the Irish, is probably the best way forward. It basically comes down to a straightforward decision as to whether you get the Irish to reverse their opposition to the Lisbon Treaty or whether you let the Lisbon Treaty go. Now, nobody, apart from the extremely Eurosceptic president of the Czech Republic, who doesn't have the power to decide these things, is declaring this treaty dead. On the contrary, they're looking for ways to resurrect it. If the only way to resurrect it is to make some concessions to the Irish and then ask them to vote again, I wouldn't put that past them. For the time being, the Irish are saying we can't do that. But they will be made offers that many people here in Brussels hope that the Irish will not be able to refuse. And we'll have to see what happens.
And do you think that that is doable? Because when the Nice Treaty was rejected, it was quite clear what had caused the no vote. There were fears that Ireland's abortion laws could be changed. There were question marks over Irish neutrality. This time, there seemed to be lots and lots of reasons why people voted no. Quite difficult to pin it down, isn't it?
Very difficult to pin down. Also, there was a very healthy turnout. There can be no complaint that this was undemocratic. The main reason that the Irish voted no is that they didn't know what they were voting for in the first place. That is the fault of the treaty drafters. Nobody really understands this treaty. Hardly anyone has read it. It's utterly indigestible.
And finally, can I just ask you a general question? You said that Nicolas Sarkozy had said he'd like to see this wrapped up by the autumn. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, has said that she wants the ratification process to continue. So has José Manuel Barroso, the President of the European Commission. Do these people understand, do these leaders understand that something out there is happening? I mean, you covered the no vote in the Netherlands 3 years ago, which came a few days after the no vote in France. There have been quite a lot of no votes, and yet the process keeps going. Do they get it?
That's a question that we are asking all the time. They claim, of course, that this treaty is Plan B, was a response to the rejection by the French and the Dutch in 3 years ago in their referendum, that this, in fact, enhances, promotes, deepens and expands democracy. I don't think they will be stopped. At the very least, I mean, further down the road, if the Irish were asked to vote again and said no again, of course, that would be a much, much bigger crisis.
That was Ian Traynor in Brussels. Dennis McShane, let me turn to you first. Don't Ian's last comments show there is a fundamental problem here? Three countries have voted no to this project. France and the Netherlands, of course, rejected the EU constitution back in 2005, and yet EU leaders just want to keep pressing ahead.
It's the fundamental debate, if you like, Nick, between parliamentary representative democracy and the democracy of referendums and plebiscites. I started my political life in a campaign against a referendum to bring back capital punishment, which, had it been held 30-odd years ago, uncertainly would have reintroduced capital punishment. As Ian said, you had an Irish Prime Minister who told his people, "I haven't even read the Lisbon Treaty." That's rather like having a lawyer who's drawing up a contract to buy a house or a business saying, "Well, I haven't actually bothered to read this contract." So in a way, if the Irish Prime Minister wasn't prepared to read the treaty and understand it and explain it to the Irish people, why on earth should the Irish people vote yes?
But isn't there a bigger problem than the Irish Prime Minister not reading the treaty, which is that three countries and three varying countries, you know, France, a large founding member of the European Union, the Netherlands, a small founding member of the European Union, and Ireland, joined in 1973, they voted no. Shouldn't this treaty just be ditched?
You can, of course, ditch it. It may well not fly, and certainly can't fly at the moment. There's no question about that. But then the same countries will be knocking on the door saying, how do we cooperate on crime? How do we cooperate against international terrorism? How do we cooperate on foreign policy, partnership with the United States? And then people say, well, perhaps we need new rules so we can cooperate a bit better. How do we bring Turkey into the European Union? You can't do it on existing rules, and it's completely dishonest of people to say we want Turkey to join, but we don't want any new rules. So we'll be back stuck in this problem. If Europe didn't exist, we'd invent it, because we don't want 27 isolated states all fighting over their borders and trade and other issues. We want to be able to live where we want in Europe without let or hindrance, I think, though there are quite a lot of people who are pretty anti-immigrant and pretty xenophobic now in Britain. So it's a great puzzle. Of course, between the European institutions and the European people, there is a big gap. And if it can't be bridged, well, okay, let's turn the clock back.
So, Dan Hannan, you're obviously not a great fan of the Lisbon Treaty, but there's Dennis McShane saying, well, if we're going to face up to the problems of the future, we do need a new set of rules.
I just don't think that's right. I mean, Dennis says, you know, we've got to have something to collaborate against international crime and so on. I don't think you'd find a single person who would disagree with that. And sovereign countries have been doing that among themselves for decades with really quite sophisticated international mechanisms. We have the Hague Convention, we have Interpol, we have extradition treaties, we recognise time spent in another state's prison as part of your sentence. You know, the alternative to the EU is not, as Dennis puts it, some kind of anarchy with 27 countries who don't talk to each other. The alternative to it is flexible collaboration among democratic countries answerable to their own people. And I have to say that last bit, answerable to their own people, is for me the key. Dennis is perfectly entitled, I have to say, he's been very consistent, he's been very clear about this all the way through, to say that he prefers the parliamentary to the plebiscitary model. The problem that I have with that is it doesn't really work in practice. When you watch a parliamentary debate, this idea that there is this kind of measured expert consideration will not survive half an hour of watching the House of Commons ratifying one of these treaties. This is how sad I am. I actually watched on the Parliament Channel most of the the debates on both readings of the bill to ratify the Lisbon Treaty. And it became perfectly clear to me that none of the MPs had read it. So before we start getting snotty about whether the Irish have read it, you know, ask how many of Dennis's colleagues in the House of Commons have. By the way, I don't blame them, because the text wasn't even available in English when the debates began. But the point is, you know, this was not a vote either in the Commons or in the Lords informed by people's conscience or by their judgment of what their constituents wanted. They'd contracted out their judgment to their whips, and I don't think that that is any better than a referendum.
Dennis.
Well, this contempt for Parliament, I mean, Daniel's got no contempt for Parliament. He's an MEP, a member of the European Parliament, and a very distinguished leader, writer and commentator for the Daily Telegraph. He's a profound Democrat. But this dismissal of Parliament really frightens me.
Dennis, have you read it cover to cover? Be honest.
Of course I have. I mean, I helped write the first blasted one, and I am lumbered. I'm one of the sad sacks who has. And actually, I'm sorry, I listened to all of those debates, and they're very measured contributions. And if you'd heard the debate yesterday on European affairs, there was Malcolm Rifkin with a brilliant speech, but also insisting the Tories had to have a referendum come what may, which I think is a bit potty.
Let me now turn to David Hurst, who, in addition to being a Guardian foreign affairs leader writer, is also our former Ireland correspondent. David Hurst, Ian Traynor was saying in that interview that we should never say never to the idea of a second referendum in Ireland. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, the last time they were forced to think again, you remember there was a very low turnout the first time, and so there was a justifiable case for holding the thing again. This time, the same excuse doesn't exist. I mean, I think the problem with Dan's argument is, although there is obviously a disconnect here, that there is a cross-European message here. This isn't just a question of the quirky Irish voters. They are expressing something that probably would be expressed in Britain if the same thing happened here. But the problem with Dan's argument, I think, is going back to what was originally said, it's impossible to discern a coherent message of the rejectionists. You know, there was one woman in Galway who said that she voted no because she didn't want her handsome son to be drafted into the Euro Army. There is no Euro Army. There may be a handsome son, but it's got absolutely nothing to do with the Lisbon Treaty. And this isn't just sort of pouring scorn on the Irish. There is a real problem here of what they were voting against. They were voting against incomprehensibility, certainly, and no one understands it. It was actually deliberately incomprehensible, because that's what Giscard d'Estaing's plan was. You actually had to make it incomprehensible, because then it wouldn't be the constitution anymore. But there is a real problem here. Now, possibly one way out of this would be a second referendum.
But Dave, isn't that an argument Dan. Against having any kind of election? I mean, I could equally say, oh, people misunderstood what they were voting for when they voted Labour at the last election. You know, they had no idea that they were going to get, you know, the Gordon Brownies, because Blair had promised to serve a full term, and therefore we should just sort of disregard it because they didn't understand what they were voting for. I mean, the point is that democracy, you may not like how people have voted, but I think you've got to accept that, you know, when you say it's not clear what they were voting against, let me suggest what they were voting against. It seems to me that they were voting against the Lisbon Treaty.
David,
and the giveaway was the ballot paper, which said, do you approve the Lisbon Treaty? Now, you know, all right, there may have been some people who misunderstood this or that at the end, but the basic argument of do you want to hand more power to Brussels, I think people understood very well that that was on the table.
David Hurst.
Yes, but, I mean, it wasn't about it. The Lisbon Treaty isn't about abortion. It isn't about a Euro Army. It isn't about tax harmonisation. All of these things are very, very difficult to combat. I mean, it was much more a rejectionist message against, I mean, every single party in Ireland, the Congress of Trades Union, almost the Catholic Church, everyone wanted a yes vote, except Sinn Féin, which has 7% of the vote.
Dennis.
So this is not...
Sorry, David. I mean, I agree with both of you. I mean, David, you can't ignore Daniel's point. The Irish people have spoken, and I agree with Daniel that the early language in the first hours after the rejection was absolutely absurd. Now I think European leaders, and they're all nationally elected ministers. Let's talk about an elite in Brussels. I mean, they are...
Apart from your Prime Minister.
No, they're all nationally elected ministers responsible to their parliaments, as our Prime Minister is. And he's taken a terrible battering on Europe from the right-wing press and the Tories, but actually I think been very tough and principled. But what we're now seeing is a new language, with Bernard Kouchner, I think, the French foreign minister, saying, we are all Europeans now. Franco Frattini, the Italian foreign minister, let's calm down. David Miliband was working the phones on last Saturday to his colleagues saying, take this Irish vote seriously. And I think that's the right approach. We've got a problem. A lot of people, Daniel, I expect, would love to have turned into a crisis. Some of the early language was making it a crisis. We now have a headache, another European headache, which we just have to work patiently at. But at the end of the day, you see, Gerry Adams and the Socialist Workers' Party will put up for election in the Irish general election, whatever it is, in a year or two, and be defeated. So, yep, they won a big vote last Thursday, but they're not going to hold government power. Mr. Sarkozy became president of France on an explicit commitment to ratify the Lisbon Treaty through the French Parliament against his opponent. Are all the people who voted for him for his policy also just to be ignored?
Great. But Dennis, you're right. Obviously,
very quickly,
there
Dan.
There's a disconnect, of course, there is between the politicians and everybody else. And that exists in every country. It exists in Britain. It exists in the Netherlands, which it voted by 86% in its parliament to ratify the constitution that 62% of Dutch voters had voted against. But you've then got to say, why do these politicians carry on swimming against the current of public opinion? I mean, it couldn't be clearer that in almost any country in Europe, given the choice, people would vote for a return of powers, not out of nationalism, not out of xenophobia, but out of wanting to have more control and wanting to
get... Very simply, in 1983, 50% of all the British people in every opinion poll wanted complete withdrawal from the European Union. Another 25% wanted huge repatriation. Mrs. Thatcher said, I'm going to take you deeper into Europe through the single European Act. She won her election. And Dan, if you always want to follow public opinion polls, believe me, we'll all end up in a very funny place.
Great. Okay, as we're talking about Margaret Thatcher, let's now turn our attention to Britain. Well, that Irish no vote dominated Prime Minister's questions in the Commons on Wednesday. Simon Hoggett, the Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, described the scenes for us.
Does the Prime Minister agree with me that following the Irish vote, the Lisbon Treaty should be declared dead?
The main topic that David Cameron raised today was Europe. He began by challenging the Prime Minister, since the Irish had voted against the Lisbon Treaty, and would the Prime Minister not declare it dead? Great, huge, massive cheer from the Tories.
Mr. Speaker, I will be attending the European Council.
Gordon Brown, of course, hasn't got the faintest idea what's going to happen. Nobody does. There is no plan B. And so he said, we respect the decision of the Irish. Well, very sarcastic cheers from the Tories at that. It was ridiculous to suggest making the Irish vote again, making them vote twice, when we in Britain haven't even had the chance to vote once. Of course, Gordon Brown, all he can do is basically say, as he does very often, that the Tories are totally opposed to Europe, have a visceral hatred of the whole idea of the European Union. 60% of our trade is with the EU, 3 million jobs depend on the EU. Tories are all in favour of enlarging the community, but aren't in favour of the necessary bureaucracy that goes with enlargement of it. Same old Tory story, he said they will the ends, but they will not will the means. Well, this ding-dong continued for quite some time.
When you were in the government, first they said they didn't want a constitution, then they said they'd accept a constitution. They said they didn't want a referendum, then they said they'd have a referendum. Then they cancelled the referendum and they brought back the constitution. Now the constitution is half dead on the floor, they haven't got the courage to kill it. Frankly, I've seen more spine and leadership from a bunch of jellyfish.
Gordon Brown was rather stung by that. He always hates accusations that he doesn't lead.
Three cheers for the Irish, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah. And Middleton stood up and gave this rather embarrassing cry. Three cheers for the Irish, Mr. Speaker. She then went on to ask, why should we ask people to obey the laws when the government flagrantly ignores an EU law which says that the treaty must be dead if one country, i.e. Ireland, votes against it? Gordon Brown didn't answer that, and a great booming voice came from the back of the chamber. Answer the question! And it was, rather sweetly, Anne Winterton's husband, Nick Winterton, demanding an answer, which, of course, he did not get.
That was Simon Hoggett. Dan Hannan, Conservative MEP, quite a strong attack from the Prime Minister on David Cameron, your leader. Why don't the Tories just admit what they really think, which is that they want to get out of the EU?
I don't think David Cameron does want that. But I mean, I do want to pick up this thing about, you know, we're anti-European, we're xenophobes. I mean, it's just such a tired, old, absurd line that, I mean, you know, I don't maybe have Dennis's extraordinary linguistic capacity, but I speak French, I speak Spanish, I write a German newspaper column. I've lived and worked all over the continent. You know, my problem with this, and I think I'm fairly typical of most Tories in this, is not that it's Europe, it's not that it involves lots of countries collaborating. You'd have to be mad to be against that. My problem with it is that it's remote and it's undemocratic, and the institutions of the EU have become self-serving and have forgotten that they're meant to answer to the rest of us. And we couldn't have had a clearer demonstration of that than in the response that they've given now to three countries having voted no. Their responses with those eerie words of Brecht, wouldn't it then be easier to dissolve the people and elect another in their place? And I think any Democrat should be against that, whether he's left, right or centre. We should be in favour of devolving power and giving people more control over their own lives.
But Dan, isn't there a flaw in your argument in that what you're saying is that what we should have with our European partners are sort of good bilateral friendly relations in the way that we have good friendly bilateral relations with the United States, but we're not in any sort of union with them? Isn't the problem with that is that that's not how France and Germany and most other members of the European Union see it? They see it as a project, and there's nothing we can do about that.
Well, their leaders do. I'm not sure their peoples do, but realistically, there's no chance of their governments changing on this. And yeah, we can't dictate how France relates to Germany. That isn't in our gift. But we can dictate what kind of relationship we have with them. And I think that what most people in my constituency pester me about and what they say to me is, you know, we wanted a common market accompanied by close intergovernmental cooperation, but we never thought that we were getting into a kind of European polity in which we would have the status of a kind of province or a subordinate state. And I don't think there is anything wrong with answering those concerns. I don't think there is any dishonour in a democratic politician listening to what people want, especially when what people want is a reasonable and moderate request. So I would like to see us, and I'm speaking for myself here as a backbencher, I mean, you know, this is going to be decided way above my pay grade and David Cameron isn't going to take his advice from me, but what I would like to see is something for Britain more along the lines of what the Swiss have, where you're in the common market, you benefit from the four freedoms of free movement of goods and services, of people, of capital, but you make your own laws, you're not in the common agricultural policy, you're not in the common fisheries policy, you can trade with outside, with countries outside the EU. You know, the Swiss seem to be doing pretty well doing that, and the Norwegians and the other states that enjoy it.
Dennis McShane, let me ask you, when you were a very, very, very young man in 1975, you voted, I take it, in that referendum, and you voted, I imagine, yes, and what you voted to was to Britain being in a common market, not, as Dan says, being in a European polity.
Well, let's just start with the first point about the Conservatives and their approach to Europe. I'm sorry, I'm just not buying into Dan's idea the Conservatives are all just gentle pro-European herbivores. Last week we had a top Welsh Tory refer to Italians as greasy wops. And David Cameron hasn't even dismissed him as a parliamentary candidate. Now, what part of greasy and wop does David Cameron not understand? And if you're in the House of Commons, I'm afraid, you do hear a low xenophobic buzz, a dislike of Europe, a scorn for anybody who's pro-European. Now, on the specific point, I lived in Switzerland for many years. The Swiss have to ensure that every one of their laws is in full conformity to EU regulations. Like Norway, they have to pay per capita more than we do to Brussels to pay the entry ticket to trade with the rest of Europe. And it's complete nonsense to think that being out of the EU doesn't mean to say the EU doesn't dictate your laws, because the laws are there to allow the common market to work.
David Hurst, from your perspective as the Guardian's foreign affairs man, how is Britain seen in Paris, Berlin and Brussels at the moment?
From all the, you know, one's contacts with French, German and Brussels diplomats, you would say that, you know, it is seen, and it has always been seen, but particularly now, very positively. I mean, I think the problem is entirely other way. How is Britain behaving in Europe? I mean, in terms of Sarkozy's last visit here, he made an extraordinary effort to fall in love with the British people. He did it for domestic reasons, and he's since regretted a few of those. But he wanted to use Britain as a new model of economic development that France could learn from. This is a bit of a first in French history. And, of course, he's had to eat his words since then. Merkel was totally happy for Sarko and Brown to stage this sort of rather extraordinary love-in. No, I think what's going to happen is that Britain, having ratified the treaty, and now going to stand back and do as little as possible to help the integrationists. And what we're going to see is a whole load of splits emerging between, you know, bigger and smaller countries over the number of commissioners, which is possibly one way out of the Irish problem. As I understand it, there is a mechanism within the Lisbon Treaty that a decision to cut the number of commissioners from 27 to 18 can be decided by the council. And that may be one way out of it, and offering a second referendum, which would become, we haven't actually discussed this whole option of the second referendum, but it would be a dramatically different one from Ireland's point of view than the first one, and it would actually become a question of Ireland's continued membership of the EU.
Great. Well, on that note, we asked Will Hutton, the Observer columnist, to look to the future.
I think that the Irish are going to be compelled by the logic of what they've done to be asked to vote a second time. I think that's going to happen next year. The Irish No campaigners are not going to like that. They're going to say, but the sovereign will of the Irish people is that this treaty shall not pass. And the EU will say, well, there's 26 other states who want it to make it pass. Come on, if you don't say yes, we'll have to have a semi-detached status for you for a period, which is already being talked about in Germany and France. The British, and particularly the Conservatives in British and the Eurosceptics in Britain, will say, we've got to have our own referendum vote on this. We've got to. This is completely unfair. If the EU are going to pressurise Little Ireland, we should step up to the plate and say, we're going to do something similar when we get office in 2010. And we will hold a referendum. And I think that referendums are, whether it be over road traffic pricing or a big issue like whether you're in and out of the EU, are very ineffective ways of doing democracy. And I'm pretty sure that in 2011 we would lose such a referendum. And I think that then Britain would be invited to do the same thing as the Irish, to have a semi-detached status inside the EU.
That was the Observer's Will Hutton. A quick question for the three of you, starting with Dennis. So there we are, Dennis, Britain heading for semi-detached status within the EU.
Certainly that was what Malcolm Rifkin was arguing for yesterday in the Commons, with William Hague nodding vigorously. It's worth reading Hansard. I asked him, are you really saying there should be a referendum in Britain were the Conservatives to come into power? He said, yes, if the Lisbon Treaty hasn't been ratified, we need a big referendum. Well, that could be a deciding moment if the Tories do win power for Britain gently detaching itself. And I think the crisis won't be a European one, it'll be a British one.
David Hurst, crisis for Britain, semi-detached status.
If that happens, I personally believe that Britain will be a big, big loser. And I don't see this from a point of view of... obviously, there are important arguments that Daniel expressed about democracy, and there's an awful lot of validity in them, and certainly in the disconnect between the people and the fat bureaucrats. But in the big picture terms, it will be an absolute disaster for Britain if you come to, China... a more, slightly more isolationist America. Certainly America under Barack Obama needs a strong European voice over practically everything. And I think although, the means to getting to the ends of Lisbon are certainly untidy, and there's an awful lot of validity in the Tory arguments about the general disquiet being felt, if you actually get to the end point, it isn't such a threatening place. In fact, I think, it's an entirely positive one.
So, Dan Hannan, a disaster for Britain if we have a semi-detached state membership of the EU, and you presumably would have to remove Ode to Joy from your iPod.
Yeah, well, I'd think twice about removing it, because it's always really annoyed me that Beethoven has been used by the EU, because it is a sublime and elevated piece of music. But semi-detached from what? The EU isn't a fixed dispensation. It's a dynamic. And it's now made clear in its reaction to these no votes where it's going to go, that it's determined on this particular course of more power to the centre, more control over foreign policy and home affairs and all the rest of it, regardless of what its people want. So I think we do have to be honest and say, is that where we are happy to end up? Are we prepared to go down this road towards the president of Europe and a European army and a European police force, which is what all the others will quite openly say is the end game? And if we're not, then yeah, what kind of relationship are we going to have? And I would like us, you can call it semi-detached, you can call it associate status, whatever you like, you can call it EFTA. I would like us to be collaborating and trading with our neighbours, to be their military allies, to have our markets open to them, to support them diplomatically, but not to compromise our democracy, not to bargain with our independence. We're a global country. We've always been interconnected. We're attached by our trading and our maritime past to every other continent. We are perfectly capable of surviving in collaboration with our immediate neighbours and also our wider neighbours. We're one of five members of the UN Security Council. We're one of the Group of Eight. We have the fourth largest armed forces in the world. We have the fifth largest economy in the world. We have great links with the US and the Commonwealth and the rest of the English-speaking world. We are perfectly capable of being a self-governing people, trading with our friends, but governing ourselves.
So we're all frenzy in the end. Well, that's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the former Europe Minister Dennis McShane, the Conservative MEP Daniel Hannan, and the Guardian leader writer David Hurst. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week for a special edition with the results of the Henley by-election. Till then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.